Graham McTavish has been living among us, though he's about to leave. Living quietly in Wellington, another actor in the capital among many talented actors, and yet this is a man who's played opposite Denzel Washington and Sylvester Stallone. Maybe we know him best as one of the more visible dwarves in The Hobbit, but he's also been a drunken weasel in The Wind and the Willows. He's a veteran Shakespearean actor. We saw him in Ali G's In the House. There was Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, the thriller Pandemic. That was him in Outlander, and as King Atlan in Aquaman. And he's prominent as well in the Uncharted video game series. There is nothing Graham can't turn his hand to, and he's turning it to a book and a TV series about Scotland. Graham, good morning to you.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jim. It really is.
It seems strange doing an interview centred on a new book which I haven't read, but we
that's how we like to do it, Jim. Nobody's allowed to actually read it. We just talk about it.
That's how it's often done, let me tell you.
I bet.
But not by me. But we wanted to catch you before you flee the country for work. You're off, aren't you?
Yes, I am fleeing the country. Well, yeah. Now I'm sad to go. I'm very sad to go. It's been wonderful being here. Especially at this time. But yes, I do have to go for work.
Okay. Clanlands, Whiskey Warfare, and a Scottish Adventure Like No Other. That's what we've got in store. And you've written it with your mate.
Yes.
Who may end up being the next James Bond.
He may do, indeed. Listen, the only thing I've said to him is if he does become the next James Bond, I have to become the next James Bond villain.
Yes.
So that I could even hope to exact revenge upon him for murdering me in Outlander.
You That's right, you were together in Outlander, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes, indeed, we were.
Not everybody knows Outlander,
yes,
but it has a lot
true.
Of fans, and they will know exactly what you're talking about.
Right.
Okay, so Sam is his name. So,
Sam Heughan.
Sam
yes.
Heughan.
Yes, indeed. I've known Sam now for, gosh, let me think, 7, 8 years. 8 years. We met in a very hot casting room in Soho in London for Outlander. And I can honestly say, and I don't say this lightly, he was somebody that I knew I would be my friend for a very long time as soon as I met him. So, and that has indeed been the case.
You would be a marvellous James Bond villain. Would he really be a good replacement for Daniel Craig?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, he is the real thing, Sam. I mean, that guy is fearless. I mean, it was one of the terrifying aspects of this story of which we've talked about in Clanlands is that he was constantly putting me into life-threatening situations in very much the style of James Bond. So, he's the real thing.
Okay. What do the two of you do in Scotland?
Originally, we were just going to do sort of GoPros. We were going to sit there, and I didn't really understand how that could possibly work. I mean, what, we're going to strap them to our heads? And so Sam eventually said, look, let's actually have cameras. And a one-camera shoot into a three-camera shoot, and we had drones and a full crew, and we went off and shot it, and we documented the experience. And the experience became Clanlands, the book. And we visited castles all over Scotland. We went to locations that people will have heard of and some that they won't, places like Loch Ness, Culloden. But we met characters that you couldn't make up in any fiction. They were really remarkable people.
So. Just to expand the explanation a bit more about the Clanlands project, it was a podcast focused on the history, culture and landscape of Scotland.
Yes, it's
and then
confusing.
It evolved into a travel show called Men and Kilt and the new book, which retains the Clanlands name.
Indeed.
Okay.
Yes, it's remarkably confusing, I do admit. But somehow it all manages to make sense to us. Yeah, the TV show is different because obviously it's a different medium. And the book concentrates on, yes, the experience of making the show, but also our own personal history, our own careers, our own friendship, and very much the history of Scotland itself.
A lot of New Zealanders will be looking forward to this because there's a lot of Scotland in New Zealand and they helped give us our accent, for one thing.
They did. And not a lot of people realise that, actually. But they did, absolutely, especially when you go to the south.
Yeah.
You could be in Scotland. Yeah, the landscape, the people, Very much the character of the people of New Zealand echoes the character of the people of Scotland, and it's why I feel so very at home here, really.
Yeah, and we've been very glad to have you here. So a confessional meets a road trip meets a death-defying experience. Yeah.
The death-defying experience aspect of it was really... Sam seemed determined to test me to the very limits of my abilities. So we were constantly being put into different modes of transport, a tandem bike, which was basically a piece of rusting farm machinery masquerading as a bike that we rode around on. We did kayaking, we were rowing boats, we had a camper van, we had a motorbike and a sidecar. It was, and I'm quite a quiet guy, really. You know, I'm very good at pretending to be this sort of tough warrior-like figure, but really my idea of a good time is sitting with a nice flat white and reading a book.
Oh, no, don't tell us that, Graham. I had this image of you as extremely tough and very the wrong man to meet in a dark alley.
Well, you know, listen, Jim, honestly, I have my moments, yes. I have my moments, but Sam takes it to a whole other level.
Graham McTavish is with us. How dangerous did it get? We know about Bradley and his son, you know, Breaking Dad, that series on TV here at the moment. Mm. But I gather it's a step up from that.
I mean, the most dangerous thing definitely was our last day of shooting. And the last day of shooting, I mean, I don't really want to spoil it, but it was very dangerous. It became very dangerous indeed. And not to put too fine a point on it, I did nearly die. So it was, it was a very sobering moment for everybody. It was a really shocking experience for me, and I don't wish to make light of it.
This death-defying experience in which you nearly died, can you give us even a little clue? Did it involve a cliff face, jumping out of a plane, water?
It involved the motorbike and the sidecar.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
Yes. So I'd never been in a sidecar before, and I have no intention of ever doing so again.
Okay. We're getting a slight picture here. Combined with speed, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Indeed.
Scotland is small, even compared with New Zealand. It would fit into the North Island easily enough.
For sure. But I think the mistake that people make, and this is certainly a mistake that many of my American friends have made, when they go to Scotland, they think they can just see the entire country. I mean, that is, well, in fairness, that's a mistake people make about New Zealand as well. They think, oh, it's just tiny, you know, we can get around easily. But they don't take into account how difficult it is to actually get around. Because like New Zealand, the roads in Scotland, apart from a couple of motorways, are very, very narrow. They're just two-lane highways, and they wind around enormous mountains. So getting from A to B can be lengthy, but it's so rewarding. It's so rewarding.
It is a very... I'm one of those people who hasn't seen it properly, but it is a marvellous place to visit. Graham McTavish is with us. You mentioned the castles. Now, I'm lucky enough to own a couple of old books about Scotland, travelogues by H.V. Morton, the great travel writer of the 30s and 40s.
And, oh, wow.
Well, he talks about visiting one of the old noble houses, and I looked this up last night. He says, all over the country, the last lovely candles of the 18th century are being blown out by the tax collector.
Yes.
How much of the magnificence of the Scottish past is left?
Well, that is a very, very good point. I don't think people realise when they go amongst the landscape of Scotland that what they're actually seeing in many ways is a landscape of tragedy. You know, a landscape that was populated by the Highland people was decimated in the late 18th and into the middle of the 19th century. With the Highland clearances, and which prompted the emigration of many, many Scottish people to New Zealand, Canada, America, Australia, and my family, well, part of my family were among them. And so, yes, it's a landscape that speaks of quite a dark past in lots of ways. I think there's a tendency to romanticise Scotland, and especially the Highland life, and it was a very, very tough life. And the Highland life pretty much came to an end at Culloden in 1746. And subsequently, the Highland people were struggling to make a living and even to have a culture. Their language was banned, their dress was banned, bagpipes, you know, all of the things that we associate with Scotland, it was almost ethnically cleansed. So, yeah, it is a beautiful country. But when you're walking around it, you're also walking among ghosts, for sure.
Walking among ghosts. I remember stopping in Ireland to look at where the Battle of the Boyne, epochal battle, was fought, and I couldn't see much at all. When you visit Culloden, because it was such a turning point in Scottish history, do you get an idea of what actually happened to the Scots on that dreadful day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if anybody gets the chance, if they're in Scotland, I urge them to visit that battlefield. It's a very, very haunting experience. The battlefield is incredibly well preserved. It's very informative. But you also, when you walk the battlefield, you really get a sense of the hopelessness of what the Highland people were facing. They were in exactly the wrong place to do what they were best at, which was the Highland Charge. The Highland Charge relied on an almost sort of overwhelming shock tactic. So they would just basically scream their heads off and run at you carrying a broadsword, a shield and a dirk, and terrify the living daylights out of you. And it worked. It worked on many, many occasions. But at Culloden, it was a boggy moor. The line was skewed, so some of them had to run 700 metres, some of them only 400, and most of them never even made it to the British line. And in the space of, I don't know, I think it was about half an hour, thousands of Highlanders were dead. I think it was 5,000 or 6,000 Highlanders, facing, in some cases, their neighbours. There's a real misconception that the Battle of Culloden was a battle between the English and the Scottish. It definitely wasn't. 4 out of 16 of the regiments at Culloden that were British were Scottish. They were made up of Scots. So it was a civil war, as much as anything else.
I don't know. There were so many Scots fighting for the English in Culloden.
Yeah. Well, it was very political. It really was a turning point about whether you wanted to look forward at a new Scotland, which was an outward-looking Scotland, a Scotland that was part of the Union, that was going to expand the British Empire and all the rest of it, or if it was more about essentially an independent Scotland.
Yeah.
And you know, things that are echoed indeed today. If, for instance, some of the castles we went to, the Mackenzies being one, they had a foot in each camp. So often the wife would be a Jacobite supporter and the husband would be a supporter of the crown. And in that way, whatever happened, they were covered. So there was a lot of political manoeuvring going on as well. And unfortunately, the poor local Highlanders were the ones that suffered from it.
History is always more complicated than...
Absolutely.
What we tend to read in the books. Whisky features in the title of your book.
Yes.
How often did it feature through the course of your journey?
Well, first of all, I need to emphasise that we did not drink and drive. No. We arrived one morning, it was actually our first day, we arrived at 9 a.m. at a pub in Scotland called the Clachaig Inn. And there was a whisky tasting for us there. And it was 6 cask strength whiskies that we had to try. Mm. And now, I drink whiskey. I do. Sam worships whiskey. He would always have some with him. He would always secrete it around his person. There would be little flasks everywhere.
I'm sorry to hear that on Sam's behalf. I hope his liver's going to survive this.
He's a fearsome man.
Whiskey seems to be in vogue again in action movies as the drink of the hard-charging man or woman. I've noticed this. It's had a revival.
Oh, is that right?
I
mean, whiskey, well, listen, I do like it. I do like it. And certainly don't want to paint the picture of Sam as some kind of raging alcoholic. But
you've done your best.
No, yeah, true. He'll thank me for that. He really understands whiskey. So I'm a really good bluffer.
Yeah.
So I can go up and say, barman, you know, give me a nice 20-year-old malt, and they'll give me something, and I can really good impression of somebody who understands what they're sniffing and tasting. But Sam really understands it.
If he gets to be Bond, he'll say, "Forget the shaken, not stirred. Just give us a dram."
Oh, totally.
Now, it doesn't sound like the book is a grim trip at all, although you went to Culloden. You also presumably went to the far-flung islands, the Shetlands, the Orkneys. Did you go everywhere?
We travelled all over. We went down to Kintyre, where the McTavish family are from. We're all over. Wherever the camper could take us, we went there.
And you're from Glasgow originally, I think.
Indeed. They were driven out of the Highlands for the very same reasons I've described, rural poverty. And I think it was my great-great-great-grandfather arrived from the Highlands, so Gaelic would have been his first language in Edinburgh. He would have probably been somebody that was given a pretty hard time, to be honest. He would have been regarded as an outsider and little more than a savage. I've done a lot of research on my own family history, and it's a remarkable thing that I look at the marriage certificate. I think it's of my great-grandfather. And their marriage certificate has two X's by the signature because they were illiterate.
Ah.
And this was in 1870.
Gee.
I know. And my father was born in 1922 and went on to become an airline pilot. And it's an extraordinary thought that in the space of 50 years, you know, you'd have a couple of people who literally couldn't read and write, and then they had a descendant who was able to fly a plane. And it really speaks to me about the lack of opportunity that a lot of Highlanders faced at that time, the waste of their abilities and their talents.
And yet, Scotland is a place of such ability and talent. You know, there's all the oppression, there's all the misery and the violence of Scottish history, and yet per capita, it would be hard to find another country on earth which has generated so much invention and creativity.
Absolutely. I've thought about trying to put my finger on why. You know, there must be something in the deep background of the Scots, in the Highland tradition, that perhaps encourages that sort of thing. It's a fascinating thing to me that a country, as you say, that is so small, has created so much and contributed so much to the world.
Yeah. Part of it was the education, wasn't it? They actually tried hard.
Yeah.
They excelled in education despite all the constraints, didn't they?
Absolutely. And in fact, the Scottish education system is still, I think, one of the best that I know of.
So a marvellous place.
Oh, yes.
And you had marvellous adventures. We know you, of course, for personally, in the sense you've done lots of roles, but you were Dweilin the Dwarf in The Hobbit.
I was.
Is that what drew you to Wellington in the first place?
Yeah. I mean, I was asked to do it. I was living in Los Angeles at the time with my family, and I got the opportunity and I jumped at it. I remember the last meeting that I had with Peter Jackson and Fran and Philippa Boyens, they said, now, you're going to be over there for quite some time, you know. You're going to be in New Zealand. You're going to be in these far-flung corners of New Zealand running around in the countryside. Are you going to be okay with that? And I went, yes. Yes, I am. And I remember the very first day, actually, we had a barbecue, like, for everybody to get to meet each other and all the rest of it. And I remember saying to Fran that somebody out of the cast will end up staying here who's not already a New Zealander. And she went, really? And I said, yeah, I'm pretty sure. And it was me.
That's you.
So, yeah.
You're off to Scotland to get back to filming.
I'm doing more filming with Sam. We are going to be doing a little more of running around the countryside because we just can't get enough. and I'm also finishing a movie for Netflix, which, of course, I can't say what it is because nowadays you're threatened with all sorts of legal injunctions if you talk about anything that you're involved in.
Oh, really?
And similarly, yes, it's true. Oh, my goodness. I've probably got a sniper at this very moment with a gun pointed at my head. And I'm also going to be starting on a Netflix series in the UK, which I also can't tell you anything about.
You're in such demand. And you're so mysterious. And you're at the comic conventions and you have a good time with the fans. Can I ask you a question?
Mm.
What do directors see in you when they first see you? I mean, a lot of them will know you in advance, but let's just say you've appeared. And what do they want from you when they look at you?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm sure you're the same. You don't see yourself as the way a lot of people will see you.
No.
You know, I see myself as quite a sort of jovial, fun individual, but my children assure me that I can look absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
And not with them, I hasten to add, but just I think my resting expression can be quite intimidating.
Yeah.
And that's certainly, I mean, it's something I've totally inherited from my father. I look exactly like my dad, and he always had this sort of fearsome expression. That's what they like. And also, you know, I mean, the business being what the business is, you do certain roles and you become known for doing a particular type of role, and that's what they look for you to do in the future.
Yeah, a lot of us know what you mean by resting faces.
Yes.
Playing opposite Denzel Washington, opposite Sylvester Stallone, twice in the Rocky franchise, Nicole Kidman, people like that.
Yeah.
Did you discover these people put their socks on one at a time like we do? I suppose it's...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of effort made to sort of conceal the mortality of these people, you know, that, you know, mainly by the people who represent them. They themselves are very, very approachable. I mean, Sylvester Stallone, for instance, was a revelation to me. You know, apart from his ability to kill people on screen, he's also a very, very intelligent man, very funny. He loves improvisation, which I was really surprised by. My first day on Rambo, he said to me, he said, do you like improvisation? And I said yes, I really do like improvisation. Yeah, that's great. Okay, we're going to just improvise this scene. And we improvised pretty much every scene of dialogue that I was involved in with him. And he was hilarious. But the other thing, the thing that sets those people apart, though, those kind of people, and Peter Jackson I would put in the same camp, not an immediate comparison that you would think you'd make between Sylvester Stallone and Peter Jackson, but they do have this in common. They are driven individuals.
Yeah.
Driven. They work incredibly hard. The days that those people put in would crush most people. Sly is the hardest working guy on any set.
Right.
You know, and that's why he's where he is.
The key that unlocks their success. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're a big name player in the video game world. Do you actually play any of these games?
No. Hopeless. Hopeless. No. I'm the guy, I think the only time I tried it, I'm the guy that shoots in a circle around his own feet.
Right.
Yes, that's me. No, I've done a lot of video games. Some of them are very, very popular, apparently. I did a trilogy, it's more than a trilogy, Uncharted, which is very popular,
yep.
Call of Duty, Dante's Inferno. I did, lots and lots of these things. It's nothing personally against people that play video games. I just really like reading. That's my thing. I like reading books.
What's that like? No, I'm just joking. A couple of questions just to finish. when are we going to see Clanlands? When are we going to read Clanlands?
Clanlands comes out, is published on November the 5th.
And as for the further ramblings of the two of you through Scotland,
yes.
When will they be viewable?
Well, it's going to be early next year.
When will you be back in New Zealand? Will you not come back, laddie?
Oh, I'm coming back, mate. Don't worry. I'm coming back. I know I can't wait to come back. I mean, the hardest thing for me when I leave is obviously leaving my kids here. I don't see my kids while I'm away. Sometimes, if I'm away for a very long time, they can come. And in fact, when I did Outlander, they lived with me in Scotland. But that's going to be hard being away. But so I'm going to come back as soon as I can. When I do come back, I mean, I know obviously at the moment there's the quarantine and everything like that when you come back into the country. But frankly, even if it meant at the end of it, I only had 3 or 4 days with the kids, I would make the trip.
Yeah. Ah, bless. Yeah. You're a good dad, I can tell. And gee, it's great being able to talk to you before you left. Hey, thank you for coming in to talk to us.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Graham McTavish.